Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Episode number 230 of Real Life Ghost Stories. And to kick things off this week, I would like to say thanks to some of our newest Patreon subscribers. I would like to thank Melissa Ace, Philip Norris, Kayla, Zaya, Kylie Seacomb, Jackie, Sherry Morgan, and Yassine L. Mernisi. Thank you so much for subscribing to the Patreon. I love you and appreciate you every single day. And our film review this week, our film review is Immaculate. Immaculate was released in 2024. It has 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb and 71% on Rotten Tomatoes. An American nun embarks on a new journey when she joins a remote convent in the Italian countryside. However, her warm welcome quickly turns into a living nightmare when she discovers her new home harbours a sinister secret and unspeakable horrors. Do you know what it is, right? I can't even be arsed to try and be diplomatic about this film. It was a crock of shit. And the further I am away from this film, the more annoyed I am by it. Right, but I'm gonna do the likes and dislikes, okay? Sinead and I went to see this in the cinema and we had very similar feelings about it. So firstly, on my likes column, I thought the imagery in the film was beautiful. So I love religious imagery. I have a tattoo of the Virgin Mary. My house is full of religious pictures. I'm a big fan of religious imagery and I think it's from growing up Catholic. I love a church. If I'm in any country in the world, in any city, in any town, you best believe I'm visiting churches while I'm there. So I loved the religious imagery. There was a lot of choir singing throughout the story, which I thought was beautiful. At one point though, they started singing Carol of the Bells. And I don't know if they were trying to indicate that it was Christmas time, but it did feel really out of place. If you are unsure of Carol of the Bells, it's the one that's the Christmas song that's like, da 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 da, holy crap, here comes Jesus, and he doesn't look too happy. It's that one. I just wanted to make a Family Guy reference if you're a Family Guy fan. It really was a visual treat, and I loved the setting, this big, old, sprawling Italian convent with these big, ornate rooms. Like, I really liked it. I also thought that Sydney Sweeney, when they sort of decked her out to look like the Virgin Mary, I thought that was really stunning imagery. I thought it was beautiful. I thought she looked the part and she also looked frightened and confused and reticent and looked like she was there against her will, and it looked really good. I thought, yes, this is great. This looks beautiful. And I did think the story had the potential to be really interesting. You know, you have Sydney Sweeney getting pregnant and everybody telling her it's the Immaculate Conception and she's frightened. She hasn't chosen this. She's really confused. She doesn't know what's happening. Everyone's treating her differently. It has the potential to be a really good story with a really strong message. Do I think that this film achieved that message? No, I don't. I'm not going to give away any spoilers for this film because it's still in the cinemas and I know there's lots of people who would still want to go and see it. So I can't really discuss all of the reasons why I disliked it so much, but just know I did dislike it a lot, you know. So from the off, right, I'm into my dislikes column. The likes column was quite short. From the off, this film is gory and bloody and gruesome. Literally, the opening sequence made me wince and cover my eyes. I was like, wow. Christ, okay, this is how we're starting off. It's grim. There's a lot of really gory shit throughout this film, but I thought the gore and the violence was wildly unnecessary. It achieved nothing. It added nothing. It was like it was like they sort of thought, oh, this plot is a bit weak and also this script is a bit weak. I know. We'll add some broken bones, some removed appendages. We'll add some unnecessary gore and people being set on fire. Listen, and that will fill in the blanks. Well, guess what? It does not. And like I say, I am somebody who does not like gore in films, but I can respect films when it is there and it is necessary and it adds to the story. This added nothing. It added nothing to the story. And like I said, I really felt like this story had brilliant potential, but it went absolutely nowhere. There were so many loose ends that weren't tied up, that were clearly just added in for the spook factor. So to give an example, without giving too much away about the storyline, frequently from the beginning of the story, we see these nuns that have like red fabric covering their faces. We see them all the time. We see them throughout the story. You never know who they are. You never learn. Sorry. You never learn who they are. They're just there. And I thought the whole way through, maybe we'll get some explanation as to why these nuns look like they're going to some sort of sex party. Are they sex nuns? Are they sex party nuns? Is that why they're wearing those sort of red masks over their faces? What's happening here? But we get no explanation at all. There's also an implication at one point that Sydney Sweeney's character, Sister Cecilia, that she was, so we learned that she drowned when she was younger and was brought back to life, and that that's the reason why she devoted her life to God. And we sort of get this weird impression that the other people in the convent, so the Reverend Mother, the priest and the Archbishop, that they have been watching Sydney Sweeney from her childhood and sort of always knew it was going to be her that was going to have this immaculate conception. But that's never explored. It's just sort of implied heavily. And then we never explore that any further. There's no explanation as to why a convent in rural Italy would be keeping tabs on a child in rural America, in small town America, before she became a nun. It just makes no sense. And I think part of the reason why I disliked this film is the strange discourse around this film. So after I'd watched it, I sort of thought to myself, how has this got 71% on Rotten Tomatoes and 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb? How has that happened? Now, granted, that might have changed in the time that I have written this and recorded it, because it often does change quite quickly with new films. But there was lots of people that I saw online that were saying, you know, this film is a real cerebral psychological horror. I even saw one commentator saying it's the best psychological horror of the last 40 years. It's not. There's nothing psychological about it. There's nothing to unpick. There's nothing to try and understand, except maybe whether or not the nuns are wearing sex masks, and if so, why? I didn't feel like there was anything remotely psychologically challenging about it. And that's not some sort of exercise in intellectual superiority. I would be the first person to say if I just didn't get something. But I just thought this film wasn't that deep. There is also a lot of conversation online about how this film is a commentary about women and bodily autonomy, and how it's about ideas around religious oppression and sexuality, and you know, on the surface of it, you hear those things, and I hear those things, and I think, yeah, this is my type of film. I didn't read that into this film at all. In fact, when I was watching the film, I kind of got the ick from a lot of scenes in the film. So, for example, there is this protracted scene where the nuns are bathing, and while they are bathing, they are wearing white night dresses, and as you can imagine, when you're wearing a white night dress and you're bathing and it gets wet, it's going to go see-through, right? So you have this quite protracted scene of these nuns where they are essentially nude, but they are all of a certain age and all of a certain body type, despite the fact that there are primarily much older nuns in this particular convent. And then I read this interview with the director and Sydney Sweeney, and this director has directed Sydney Sweeney a few times, and he said, I don't want to be known as the director who just gets Sydney Sweeney naked. So that was the justification for the flimsy white nightgown in the bath scenes. And they also spent quite an interesting amount of time, both of them, in that interview justifying all of the reasons why her character would not be wearing a bra. And I just thought, fine if she's not wearing a bra, but also why is there a need to vehemently justify it? And maybe that's just me being prudish. Maybe those scenes were justified. Maybe they were necessary. Maybe they served a purpose to comment on female autonomy. I didn't feel like they did. I felt like actually they sort of did the opposite, and it felt very objectifying of these young women to me. And maybe the film just wasn't for me, but I feel like the hype is overblown for this one, for real. And I'm going to say something which might upset some people, because I know that she has a cult following, but I don't think Sydney Sweeney is a very good actor, and I don't think that she was the right person for this role. Now, granted, she was given very little to work with because her character was very two-dimensional, when actually a bit of depth to her character probably would have been fantastic. It would have been brilliant. I feel like I could rant about this film for ages. I'm not going to, because I'm conscious of my 10-minute allocation to the film review. So I'm just going to say this. It's very gory. I don't think it's as deep and cerebral as the reviewers are saying that it is. And I just didn't particularly enjoy it. And it's going to be a 1.5 star for me. So that's 1.5 stars for Immaculate. And I feel like it's lucky to get that extra half a star, to be honest.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Which brings us to our story this week. Now, this particular location has been on my list of episodes to do for a really long time, and it seems fitting to release this on Easter Sunday. I generally don't do themed episodes, mostly because I forget that there's, you know, things in the calendar that happen at the same time every year. But this time I thought to myself, okay, we're going to do an Easter themed episode, but something a little bit different. So let's get into it. Nestled in the heart of Dublin, Kilmainham Jail stands as a silent witness to Ireland's tumultuous past. Its weathered walls have borne witness to centuries of struggle, resilience, and revolution. From its inception in the late 18th century to its closure in the 20th century, Kilmainham Jail has played a central role in shaping Ireland's history, serving as a symbol of both oppression and liberation. The story of Kilmainham Jail begins in 1796, when construction commenced under the director of John Traill, a prominent architect of the time. The jail was designed to replace the outdated Newgate Prison and provide a modern facility for incarcerating criminals. Situated on the outskirts of Dublin and built on the ominously named Gallows Hill, Kilmainham Jail was a formidable structure, built in the style of a panopticon, with wings radiating from a central hub, allowing for efficient surveillance of prisoners. Kilmainham Jail became synonymous with political prisoners who were incarcerated for fighting against British occupation of Ireland. One of the founders of the United Irishmen, Henry Joy McCracken, was the first significant political prisoner to be kept in Kilmainham Jail. He was imprisoned there on the 11th of October 1796 and was hanged 2 years later. Robert Emmet, another of the leaders of the United Irishmen, organised a rebellion in Dublin in 1803. He, accompanied by Anne Devlin, was held in Kilmainham while he awaited trial for treason. He was executed later the same year, while Anne spent another 2 years in the jail. 1821 was the last year in which women were put to death by public hanging in the jail. Bridget Butterly and Bridget Ennis were the last two women to be so hanged, aged 19 and 21 years old, respectively. In the first half of the 19th century, Kilmainham Jail was used for holding prisoners sentenced to be transported to the prisoner colonies in Australia. Over 4,000 prisoners bound for Australia were processed in Kilmainham Jail during this period. However, its significance transcended its role as a mere correctional facility. During the Great Hunger of the 1840s, Kilmainham Jail became wildly overcrowded with men, women and children, all starving, and many imprisoned for petty crimes such as stealing food or begging. There were 5 people in cells that were built for one. Men, women and children were all incarcerated together. There were no beds, just straw to sleep on. Disease was rife. According to a report from the Inspector General in 1847, numbers of these wretched creatures are obliged to lie on straw in the passages and day rooms of the prison without a possibility of washing or exchanging their own filthy rags for proper apparel. Upon the necessity of passing this act, it is not our place to pass an opinion, but of its effect upon the condition of the jails, we are painfully conscious. The committing of vagrants led to the introduction of fever and dysentery into a crowded prison and the sacrifice of many lives. The mid-19th century marked a turning point in the history of Kilmainham Jail, as Ireland's quest for independence intensified. In 1848, following the failed Young Irelander Rebellion, the jail became a symbol of British oppression, as prominent nationalist leaders, including William Smith O'Brien and Thomas Francis Marr, were incarcerated within its walls. Their imprisonment sparked widespread outrage and galvanised support for the Irish nationalist cause. Women made up a large population of the jail until the year 1881, when it was turned into a prison for men only. Throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Kilmainham Jail became synonymous with political imprisonment, as generations of Irish revolutionaries were detained within its confines. Notable inmates included Charles Stewart Parnell, the charismatic leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party, who spent several months in Kilmainham following his involvement in the Land League agitation. Parnell's imprisonment only served to bolster his popularity and strengthen the resolve of the Irish nationalist movement. The jail shut as a prison for criminals in 1910. It was handed over to the British Army, who used it as a military detention centre. But the jail reached the zenith of its significance during the Easter Rising of 1916, a seminal event in Irish history that ultimately paved the way for independence. On Easter Monday 1916, rebel groups consisting of members of the Irish Volunteers and the Irish Citizen Army seized strategic buildings in Dublin city centre and proclaimed the Republic of Ireland. The rebellion lasted a week before the rebels surrendered. Kilmainham Jail was reopened to house the hundreds of men and women who had taken part. In May 1916, 14 leaders of the Easter Rising, including James Connolly and Padraic Pearse, were executed by firing squad within the jail's stone walls. James Connolly had been so badly injured in the Rising that he had to be carried to his execution and was executed tied to a chair. Their martyrdom ignited a flame of defiance across Ireland, hastening the demise of British rule. In the aftermath of Ireland's independence in 1922, Kilmainham Jail's role underwent a profound transformation. No longer a symbol of British oppression, the jail struggled to find a new identity in the fledgling Irish Republic. Over the ensuing decades, it gradually fell into disrepair, its crumbling walls bearing the scars of neglect and indifference. Despite its diminished stature, Kilmainham Jail remained a potent symbol of Ireland's turbulent past. In 1960, the Irish government designated it as a national monument, recognising its historical significance and cultural value. Efforts were made to preserve the jail's heritage, and in 1966, it was opened to the public as a museum, offering visitors a glimpse into Ireland's revolutionary past. Today, Kilmainham Jail stands as a poignant reminder of Ireland's journey from colonisation to independence. Its austere corridors echo with the whispers of the past, recounting tales of defiance and sacrifice. Visitors from around the world flock to its gates, drawn by a desire to pay homage to those who dared to dream of a free and sovereign Ireland. Kilmainham Jail occupies a hallowed place in the annals of Irish history. From its humble beginnings as a provincial prison to its emergence as a crucible of revolution, it has borne witness to the ebb and flow of Ireland's tumultuous past. Its history is long and turbulent, and was home to years of pain, suffering, and untimely death. It seems inevitable, therefore, that there would be ghosts lingering in the cells. One of the first recorded ghostly experiences in the jail comes from the 1960s, when the jail was first being refurbished. The Irish government had recognised that the jail held monumental significance as a historical landmark, but also as a symbol of political upheaval and the Irish struggle for freedom. It was decided that the jail would be refurbished and opened as a tourist attraction and museum. During this period, Governor Dan McGill was stationed at the jail with his family. They lived in the old warden's quarters. One night, Dan had done the usual round of the jail, making sure the doors were locked, the building was secure, and the lights were all off. He returned to his quarters and retired to his bedroom. As he was closing the curtains, a burst of light caught his eye. The lights were on in the chapel, burning across the courtyard. He was sure he had turned the lights off in the chapel. Grumbling, he put his dressing gown back on and made his way out into the cold, across the courtyard and into the chapel. There was always a possibility that some of the local young lads had made their way into the prison full of misguided mischief and bravery. But he was sure that he had turned all the lights off. He had made his way into the chapel, breath misting out in front of him in the cold night air. The chapel was bathed in the harsh white light, but it was mercifully empty. Dan switched the lights off and locked the doors of the chapel and turned back towards the living quarters. He had only taken a couple of steps across the courtyard when he was bathed in a white glow. The lights had turned on once again in the chapel. This time he knew he had locked the door behind him, and he knew the lights were absolutely off. They had been switched back on. This time he felt a cold chill run down his spine, and it took him a few seconds to turn around, to psych himself up to turn around. When he did, the chapel was standing quietly, in the same state that he had left it in, except now it was stubbornly alight. He unlocked the door, ignoring the slight quiver in his hands, and he entered the chapel again. It was, of course, empty. He had half expected to see some ghoul or pooka standing next to the light switch, grinning a maniacal grin, waiting for him. But the chapel was empty. He again switched the lights off and locked the doors, and this time he half walked, half ran back to the living quarters. It was only when he made it back to his bedroom that he realised that his heart was hammering in his chest. He removed his housecoat and climbed into his bed, deciding not to tell his wife about what had occurred. He turned out the lamps, expecting to be plunged into darkness. But the room remained slightly illuminated. He was briefly puzzled, but the quickening of his heart rate informed him of his dread before his brain did. His legs were like jelly as he slowly stepped out of the bed. He pulled the curtains back an inch and looked through. The chapel was illuminating the darkness. The lights flooded the courtyard. Dan made the decision that he would not be leaving his bedroom again to investigate. The lights in the chapel turning on and off during the night would become a regular feature in his life during the restoration of the jail. It had not just been lights turning on and off that have been reported in Kilmainham Jail. Many construction workers have reported hearing footsteps on a regular basis, footsteps that would run towards them up the stairs or down the corridor, footsteps that would then stop in front of them. They would be engulfed in cold air before the footsteps would continue running on their journey. Sometimes these footsteps would be light and quick, like the footsteps of a child, and other times they would be the heavy footsteps of an adult. Not only this, but people regularly reported hearing the trudging, marching footsteps of soldiers passing them in various parts of the prison. Perhaps the most terrifying story to come from Kilmainham Jail is one of a very physical, invisible presence that seems to lurk in the depths of the dungeon. A painter was working alone in the dungeon when he was suddenly gripped by an unseen force. It was like a gust of wind caught him and flung him across the room, pinning him against the dungeon wall. He was stuck, pinned and struggling against the wall, and he eventually managed to wriggle free and fled the dungeon, vowing never to return again. People who visit Kilmainham Jail regularly report hearing cell doors slamming, hearing footsteps of children and adults and soldiers running or walking through the corridors. People report that they hear voices, that they feel cold spots. Psychic mediums who have visited have stated that there's an evil presence in the chapel and something else lurking in the dungeon. But there is an actual apparition that is said to appear in the jail, who has been seen countless times over the years. She has appeared in the pictures of tourists and been seen by tourist groups numerous times. It is, of course, only speculation as to who this spectre is, but there are many who believe that it is the ghost of Grace Gifford. If you're Irish and you're listening to this, you will likely know the story of Grace, even if you don't know her surname. Her story has been immortalized in song, a song that is called Grace, and is probably sung at every Irish event, weddings, funerals, birthday parties, you name it. According to the website The Irish Post, Grace Gifford was born in Dublin to a Protestant mother and Catholic father in 1888, 28 years before the rising at the GPO, which would inspire Ireland to finally break free of the British Empire. A talented artist whose work focused on cartoons, Grace was active in the Republican movement despite being raised Protestant and living an affluent childhood. She is known to have had a deep interest in Catholicism, which was exacerbated when she met her future husband, Joseph Mary Plunkett. Grace met her future husband through her brother-in-law, Thomas McDonagh, another future martyr for Irish freedom, who was married to her sister Muriel. Grace studied and was accepted into the Catholic Church after Joseph proposed to her in 1915. The pair planned a double wedding with his sister and her fiancé, and the wedding date was set for Easter Sunday 1916. But instead, the uprising, now known as the Easter Rising of 1916, took place, and Joseph was captured and imprisoned in Dublin's Kilmainham Jail along with the other leaders. Hearing that her fiancé was to be executed by firing squad at dawn, Grace bought a ring from a Dublin jeweller's and pleaded with the military authorities to allow their wedding to take place. As the famous song goes, Grace and Joseph were married on the grounds of the prison, hours before Joseph Plunkett was executed for his role in the Easter Rising. Struggling for money and for housing, with just her cartoons to sell to make a meagre wage, the chance of financial security was withheld by her in-laws, who denied her husband's will, which stated that all of his money to be left to her, as it only contained one witness's signature. Joseph Plunkett, in his final letter to his soon-to-be widow, had requested that she fight for the money as it was rightfully hers. And after a number of years, Joseph's parents agreed to pay her a sum of money, and she also received a civil pension from Eamon de Valera's government in 1932, allowing her to live the rest of her days in relative security. Grace Gifford Plunkett died in 1955 at the age of 67, and was buried with full military honours, close to her husband's final resting place in Glasnevin Cemetery. Her grave continues to receive countless visitors each year, many who were moved by the song which put music to Joseph Plunkett's last thoughts. There are many who believe the woman that is seen in the prison in period dress is the spirit of Grace Gifford. Part of the reason why people believe that it is Grace Gifford is because she seems to appear in photographs that are taken of the cell of Joseph Mary Plunkett. It is as though the spirit of Grace Gifford is holding on to the last moments that she shared with the love of her life. The Kilmainham area is also linked to another Dublin mystery. According to Dublin City Council historian in residence Catherine Scuffill, Kilmainham was once the brief home of the Lucky Stone. The Lucky Stone was a 9th century grave slab believed to have magical properties. People once queued to touch or kiss the stone in the hope of gaining a cure from illness or to get good fortune in the future. When speaking to The Independent, Catherine said, "The Lucky Stone was moved from the church during the early part of the 14th century by John Le Desser, the Lord Mayor of Dublin. He erected a drinking fountain at the corn market nearby and had the stone placed beside it. The stone disappeared on many occasions over the years, mysteriously turning up at Glasnevin Cemetery and later in Whitefriars Street Church. One of the strangest stories connected to the Lucky Stone happened in 1826. The stone had again gone missing but was found on a building site in Kilmainham. It was spotted by a watchman who reported he had seen the stone glow in the dark and then assume human form after nightfall. Adding to the mystery, workmen on the site also alleged that the stone cried out, moaned loudly and rocked from side to side when they tried to break it with a sledgehammer. It was eventually reinterred in its current position inside Old St. Audens in 1888. It is fixed firmly into place with iron holdings to prevent any more disappearances. And St. Audens is also home to the ghost of one of Dublin's most infamous women, Darkie Kelly. Most of what is known about Darkie Kelly is from tall tales and gruesome folklore, but there is truth in her story, and there are also regular sightings of the Green Lady of St. Audens. It is believed that Darkie Kelly, whose real name was Dorcas, which is derived from the Irish for dark, was born sometime in the 1730s, and that in the 1950s she was the proprietor of a brothel in Dublin, the Maiden Tower Brothel in Copper Alley near Fishamble Street, was infamous as a place of debauchery at the time. It can be assumed that Darkie started out as a sex worker and eventually worked her way up to brothel madam. She had many high-profile clients, but none more high-profile than Simon Luttrell. Now you might be thinking, I recognise that name. Simon Luttrell was the Sheriff of Dublin and was a full-fledged member of the Hellfire Club. He was known as the King of Hell and was described in a biography as publicly and privately insulted and despised, insomuch that it became a common phrase amongst most rank of people and remains to this day that if a man was inclined to confer the greatest mark of rascality and resentment against his adversary, it was enough to call him a Luttrell. Traitor, villain, bastard, coward and profligate, and everything that can be conceived odious and horrible were received, couched and understood in that one word. The story goes that Darkie Kelly and Simon Luttrell harboured a type of friendship, although I can only imagine that that friendship was largely transactional. She would provide services for him, and he would ensure the safety and continued success of her brothel. The legend goes that Darkie Kelly was accused of witchcraft by Simon Luttrell. Apparently she became pregnant, and claimed that he was the father and demanded financial support. He counterclaimed that she had used witchcraft to bewitch him and had killed the baby in a satanic ritual. She was subsequently hanged until nearly dead and then burned at the stake. But that's not actually what happened. I think it's important to remember that witchcraft accusations and trials were actually quite rare in Ireland. Darkie Kelly was sentenced to death because she was accused of murdering a shoemaker named John Dowling. It was also then alleged that the remains of five men were found in the basement of her brothel. Although without adequate documentation and records, it's difficult to know whether this was true, whether it's simply become part of the legend, or even if it was a way in which the powers that be could justify the death of a powerful local businesswoman who was also bringing the area into disrepute. After Darkie's execution, a number of local sex workers seized her remains and a riot ensued on Fishamble Street, after which 13 people were arrested for disorderly conduct. Whatever the truth of the story is, Darkie Kelly seems to have never left. She is the lady in green that appears on the steps of St. Audin's Church. A misty, dark-haired figure in a green dress appears in the late evenings. Children used to dare each other to run up the steps of St. Audin's to see if they could make it to the top and back down again without the green lady appearing. Darkie Kelly is also said to haunt the pub bearing her name. Staff and visitors report feeling watched, and items have been seen moving around. Easter is an important time of commemoration for Irish people. The Easter Monday Rising of 1916 paved the way for Irish independence. Stories of Kilmainham Jail keep the story of the Irish struggle alive. To many, they are just ghost stories. But ghost stories like these help preserve the stories of people like Joseph Mary Plunkett, James Connolly, and Grace Gifford. Stories about the great hunger and the immense pain and suffering of the Irish people. But also stories that paved the way for change and victory and hope and perseverance. So like I said, I thought Easter weekend was an appropriate time to talk about Kilmainham Jail and also to talk about other little stories that are linked to Kilmainham Jail, which then linked to Darkie Kelly, who I mentioned in the Hellfire Club episode. I sort of mentioned briefly that her life story was really interesting, and when she was executed, people rioted, like sex workers rioted on the street, and she's an interesting person to read about. The sad reality of talking about these jails that were operational in the 1718 and early 1900s is that they were all very similar in terms of the level of suffering that happened in them. And one of the interesting historical tidbits about Kilmainham Jail is that during the Great Hunger, people were trying to get incarcerated, because at least if you were incarcerated, it meant that you would get 3 meals a day, and they'd be pretty meagre, but you'd get them. And when the prison authorities realised this, they drastically decreased the amount of food that they were giving prisoners, so that it was barely enough for prisoners to survive, to try and stop people from trying to get incarcerated in order to survive the Great Hunger. And it's really difficult to quite grasp that level of desperation. I also thought it was really interesting that in the history of Kilmainham Jail, women were historically treated far worse than men, or were in far worse conditions than men. Generally, men were actually given a bed, whereas women and children were given straw on the floor. And when there was a realization that these prison conditions were unsustainable and were the reason why disease was rife and why people were dying, there was an element of prison reform whereby they separated men and women, because obviously that is not going to go well in those circumstances. And the men were given much more favourable conditions, whereas the women were still in darkened conditions with straw on the floor, with lots of them to a cell and in conditions that were unhygienic and spreading disease. And that story is pretty universal when we talk about prisons. You know, if you think about Bodmin Jail, when you think about Shepton Mallet, when you think about Spike Island, they're all prisons that we've covered on this podcast, and the conditions were pretty universally grim. Therefore, I do think it's inevitable that there is going to be some sort of energy there. Even if you are somebody who is really skeptical, and I like to think of myself as a healthy, curious skeptic, I would hazard a guess that if anywhere had the potential to be haunted, even if it's just with some sort of residual energy, it would be places like Kilmainham Jail. Especially when we talk about things like stone tape theory and residual energy, like it feels like whatever people are hearing in the jail, so like slamming doors, footsteps, kids running around, soldiers marching, that all feels That all feels like it is residual energy, like energy that the jail has absorbed and releases every now and then. I don't really know what to say about the guy being pinned up against the wall. I couldn't find where the original story of that came from, or the original story of like Dan McGill and the chapel lights coming on and off, where that came from. Apparently those two stories took place around the same time period, but I'm not entirely sure where the original source for those stories is, or if it's one of those things that's just hearsay that's been passed on down through the years. And interestingly, I have a lot of ghost books, and Kilmainham Jail did not appear in any of my Irish ghost books. Even my ghost book that's all about the hauntings of Dublin, it didn't appear in it. And what I really wanted were some really good first-hand accounts of people having incidents in Kilmainham Jail, but I couldn't find any. So really, we just had to make do with sort of general haunting shenanigans. I would highly recommend that if you do not know the song Grace, to go and listen to it. I left a link to a version of the song in the description of this episode. It's such a beautiful song. And if you can't access the description of this episode, just look up something like Grace Irish Song on YouTube. And I meant it when I said that that song is sung at pretty much every Irish function ever. If you are at an Irish wedding, funeral, birthday party, generally any Irish event, at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when everybody's well jarred, somebody will start a sing song, and that sing song can stay going until the sun comes up. And people will have a song in their arsenal, and you can be guaranteed that there will be an older man or an older woman in the congregation that will sing the song Grace. And the story of Grace Gifford and Joseph Mary Plunkett is incredibly sad, and it's very moving and very touching. But it did also make me think about the possibility of this apparition of Grace Gifford being like, what if she's a tulpa or a thought form? We've had generations of Irish people singing a song about the wedding of Grace Gifford and Joseph Mary Plunkett. Years and years of it. People being teary-eyed at 3 o'clock in the morning singing that song. People literally visiting her grave to leave flowers because they heard that song, were so moved by it, and then looked up her story. And people talk about thought forms all the time, that so many people thinking about this particular person or entity and putting so much energy into it that they almost will it into existence. We did a whole podcast episode called The Philip Experiment that is all about that very idea. And there's lots of people that say that Bigfoot is a tulpa or a thought form. So I'm putting it out there that the ghost of Grace Gifford potentially could also be a tulpa or a thought form, brought on by years and years, generations of drunk Irish people emotionally singing about her and her wedding to Joseph Mary Plunkett. As an aside, I got quite irate when I was doing the research for this episode, and I wrote this point down as a point to mention. I must say, time has passed and I'm less irate now, but I did think it was worth mentioning as just an interesting but very, I would say, inaccurate thing that I came across when reading a blog about Kilmainham Jail. There seemed to be this perspective, this person wrote very confidently, that their Irish friend had told them that no Irish people are interested in places like Kilmainham Jail, that Irish people aren't interested in places, historical places that are linked particularly to the Easter Rising and the Troubles and any buildings or places that are historically linked to the Irish struggle for independence from British rule. And the reasoning was that apparently this unknown, unnamed Irish person said that basically they just don't want to dig up the past. They want to forget about it and move on. And I just wanted to say that if you come across this opinion, I really don't think that is true. And this person who then wrote the blog was surprised that they visited Kilmainham Jail and were in a tour group that was made up of predominantly Irish people and them. And they were surprised that there was Irish people in the tour group. And I just would like to point out that as an Irish person, we can hold a grudge, and we enjoy holding a grudge. It's a very important part of our culture. In fact, I'm pretty sure that if you're looking for Irish citizenship, one of the key questions is, tell us about a grudge that you are holding and how long you have held it for. I'm obviously joking, but this particular blog was quite high up in the in the search results for Kilmainham jails. I just wanted to put it out there that Irish people do not just want to forget their past and move on and pretend that things didn't happen. We do honour our past. And moving on from Kilmainham jail to the Lucky Stone, I found that story randomly. I was looking up like the most haunted places in Dublin, blah blah blah, and there was in the Independent a section about the Lucky Stone of St. Audin's Church, and it was so sparse in the information, and I sort of loved how sparse it was. You know, why was the stone lucky in the first place? So people were visiting this stone because it had magical properties, but those properties don't seem to be specific. So it's, you can get a cure or get good luck in the future. And to kind of give you an insight into Irish stones and places and places of worship, like that might seem odd to other people, there are stones and wells and trees all over Ireland that are believed to have the cure for different things. So there is a well that you dip your head into and it's said to cure mental illness. There is like a well that you might put your hand into and it's said to cure warts. The cures are often weirdly specific, but this seems quite ambiguous. It's like, you know, you might get a cure or you might get good fortune or you might just get herpes from kissing a stone that everybody else has been kissing. And when it disappeared multiple times, why? Who is stealing it? And just to give you some perspective, the stone was in St. Audin's Church, which is a 53-minute walk from Glasnevin Cemetery by today's Google Maps standards. So you're telling me people dragged this stone at least an hour across Dublin and nobody noticed? Although if it brings good luck and they're constantly holding it the entire time, then maybe they just got really lucky on this journey that nobody noticed. And look, when it ended up in this building site and it was howling and wailing and glowing in the dark and turning into a human at night time, that does not seem like it's going to bring good fortune or the cure to me. To me, it feels like, get this thing as far away from me as humanly possible, please and thank you. And then obviously you've got the ghost of Darkie Kelly knocking around. And just to be clear, her being referred to as Darkie would have been a term of endearment that would have referenced her having dark hair. And I didn't want to go into loads of detail about the story of Darkie Kelly because it felt more true crimey rather than haunting-y. But her ghost is said to haunt the steps in a green dress. And you know what? I'd be haunting those steps too if I was hung until I was nearly dead and then set on fire, because that seems extreme. Although I would be appreciative of all of the other sex workers in the area grabbing my remains, having a massive party, having a riot on Fishamble Street and 13 people being arrested. That is what I would like to call going out with a bang. There is also another link between the Hellfire Club and St. Audin's Church, which is that Thomas Whaley, who was one of the big bad bastards who was in the Hellfire Club, who was, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, hurting people without any repercussions, etc., etc. He apparently went into St. Audin's Church and dropped to his knees at the altar and was like, "I repent my ways, I've been a terrible man, blah, blah, blah." And he turned and saw the devil coming towards him up the aisle. So he fled the church and ultimately fled the country, apparently, because he was so disturbed by what he saw. But listen, all that drinking and drugging and debauchery is going to catch up with you somehow. I am aware that this episode has been probably more history heavy, but there are some wonderful stories of people who fought, died and lived through the Irish Revolution. Like I said, I would recommend looking up the song Grace. The link to it is in the description of this particular episode. I would also recommend looking up people like Anne Devlin, the Countess Markievicz. They were really interesting characters in the Irish independence movement. I would also recommend looking up the full story of Darkie Kelly if you are somebody who is interested in historical true crime, because it is a very interesting story, which has been obscured somewhat by legend and myth associated more so with the Hellfire Club. Thank you as always for listening to today's episode. Remember, if you would like to send in your story, you can do so by emailing it to reallifeghoststoriespodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out the website reallifeghoststoriespodcast.com, and if you are desperate for some extra content, you can subscribe to the Patreon. That is patreon.com/reallifeghoststories, where for $5 a month or $2 a month you get access to heaps of extra content, as well as every single main and mini episode completely ad free. And on that note, I shall see you next time.